Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. At least 13 people were killed today in the Ukrainian city of Donetsk when a bus was hit by an apparent mortar attack. The attack sparked accusations of blame from both Ukraine and Russia. 21 members of an international coalition against the Islamic State met in London today to discuss strategies aimed at defeating the militant group. The meeting was aimed at assessing achievements of the coalition and planning the next steps of the campaign. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said tackling the threat of IS is the challenge of our time.
I think this is a challenge for all of us. It's a challenge of our time. And we need to step up and lead and be strong and be clear about what is at stake. And that's exactly why we're here and meet today.
Kerry said a lot of work still needs to be done. Yemen's cabinet submitted letters of resignation today amid a political tug of war between the president and a militia. Citing a Facebook post by Prime Minister Khaled Baa, Reuters quoted a political chief as saying the government does not want to be involved in what was called an unconstructive political maze. There was no immediate word on whether President Abd-Rabbah Mansour Hadi has accepted the resignations. Witnesses said Houthi rebels remained outside the president's house a day after the two sides agreed to end a standoff in the country's capital, Sana'a. The number of new Ebola cases in West Africa dropped sharply last week, raising hope that the regional epidemic is on the wane. The World Health Organization says 145 new Ebola cases were reported in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone in the week ending January 18th. Only 8 of those cases came from Liberia. This is VOA News. The Democratic Republic of Congo's Senate has announced a one-day delay for its vote on a proposed electoral law that has sparked days of protests. Senators now say they will vote Friday on the bill. Opponents say if it's passed, it would allow President Joseph Kabila to stay in office beyond the end of his term in 2016. The candidate of Zambia's ruling party is in the lead as returns continue to be counted in Tuesday's election. According to Zambia's Election Commission, Edgar Lungu of the Patriotic Front Party is ahead with 50% of the vote after 80 out of 150 constituencies are counted. The AFP News Service reports police in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo today fired on protesters, wounding at least 2 people. The 2 wounded people were students taking part in a demonstration in the town of Goma against President Joseph Kabila. A court in Egypt has ordered the release from prison of ousted President Hosni Mubarak's 2 sons, Alaa and Gamal. The 2 will be retried on corruption charges along with their father. The Somali Islamist group Al-Shabaab is claiming responsibility for a bomb attack at a Mogadishu hotel that killed 3 people. The blast went off a day ahead of a visit by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Erdogan denounced the attack during a speech at Addis Ababa University in Ethiopia. It is not clear if the Turkish delegation was the target of the attack. Reuters quotes Sambo Dasuki, Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan's national security advisor, as saying elections should be delayed to allow more time for the distribution of new ID cards to voters. Dasuki points out that a postponement of up to 3 months is allowed by law, but the main opposition coalition says it will oppose any postponement, and the Independent National Electoral Commission says there are no plans for such a postponement. Thailand's former Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat today presented her defense to Parliament on charges related to her alleged role in a controversial rice subsidy plan. She told lawmakers that if the case against her is politically motivated, and she said the subsidy program benefited Thai farmers. The 220-member legislature plans to vote Friday on an impeachment motion against her. U.S. news outlets say federal Justice Department lawyers are recommending that no federal civil rights charges be brought against a white police officer in the shooting of a black shoplifting suspect in Ferguson, Missouri last year. Officials say an FBI investigation of the shooting found no evidence that the officer willfully intended to violate 18-year-old Michael Brown's rights when he opened fire. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Rights groups say dozens of people have been killed this week during protests in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The protesters object to a proposed new law that critics say would extend the rule of President Joseph Kabila. The Senate is expected to vote Thursday on the legislation, raising concerns of renewed violence.
That's VOA's Cape Jaslow reporting. Details coming up. Also in the news, Human Rights Watch accuses Ethiopia's government of systematically cracking down on media ahead of the May 2015 elections. We have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from the Gambia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, rights groups say dozens of people have been killed this week during protests in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The protesters object to a proposed new law that critics say would extend the rule of President Joseph Kabila. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports the Senate is expected to vote today on the legislation, raising concerns of renewed violence.
The International Federation for Human Rights says at least 42 people have been killed in clashes with security forces in Kinshasa since Monday, when demonstrations erupted against the proposed electoral law. The organization called for Congolese authorities to put an end to what it called an excessive use of force against protesters. Human Rights Watch Congo researcher Ida Sawyer, speaking to VOA from Kinshasa, put the number killed somewhat lower, confirming 20 deaths since Monday.
In many cases, police and Republican Guard soldiers, who are part of the president's security detail, fired directly into crowds of protesters. In some cases, the protesters were also violent and hurled rocks at the police and Republican Guard soldiers. At least two policemen have died in the protest.
Opposition groups say the proposed law, which calls for a census before the next presidential election due in 2016, is a ploy to allow President Kabila to stay in power beyond the two terms mandated in the Constitution. A census would likely take 2 to 3 years in the vast underdeveloped country, which has few paved roads and many active rebel groups, especially in the northeastern provinces. Protesters so far have involved student groups, opposition activists, and civil society organizations. The influential Catholic Church has also opposed any move to delay elections.
There does seem to be popular support for the protests and for opposition to this idea of changing the electoral law to allow Kabila to stay in power. And it does look like if concessions aren't made, these protests could continue indefinitely.
Protests have also been reported in Goma and Bukavu in the eastern DRC. On Wednesday, U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki expressed concern about the violence and called for peaceful, credible, and timely elections in the DRC in accordance with the Constitution. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
In Zambia, ballot counting continues for the presidential election. So far, ruling party candidate Edgar Lungu has the lead with over 533,000 votes. In second place is opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema of the United Party for National Development. He has more than 474,000 votes. The winner will replace Michael Sata, who died last October. It's not clear when the final presidential election results will be announced. A new report by Human Rights Watch accuses the Ethiopian government of systematically cracking down on media ahead of the May 2015 elections. The report released today details how Ethiopia has restricted independent reporting since 2010. Martha Vanderwolf has the story from Addis Ababa.
Human Rights Watch says Ethiopia's environment for independent media and journalists is becoming bleaker ahead of the national election this May. Researcher Felix Horn says there are patterns of government abuses against independent journalists who have different views than the government.
After articles are written, harassment comes from government officials, security officials and cadres in the forms of threatening phone calls, SMS messages and in-person visits, trying to get the individual to tone down their writings to comply with government's perspectives on different issues. Then the next level is threats and harassments against family members, quite often arbitrary detention to intimidate and to pressure the journalist into censoring their writing. If that doesn't work, the next step seems to involve criminal charges.
The report, Journalism is Not a Crime, says that in 2014, 6 independent publications closed down because of government pressure, 22 journalists, bloggers and publishers were criminally charged, and more than 30 journalists fled the country. Most journalists are charged under the widely criticized anti-terrorism proclamation. Currently, there is a high-profile terrorism case going on in Ethiopia against bloggers of the Zone 9 group. Human Rights Watch says the repression described in the report is leading to self-censorship. The rights group also claims that citizens and junior government officials are afraid of speaking to media out of concern of being disciplined. Horn says the repression has led to a reality where alternative views about the upcoming elections are rarely discussed in the media.
It is crucial and critical that there be a vibrant and flourishing independent media that can contribute to the political discourse and the political dialogue within the country, that can provide critical information and critical analysis about the political issues of the day. But sadly, given the decimation of private media that we've seen since 2010, that's just not happening.
The ruling party, which has been in power since 1991, won over 99% of the votes in the 2010 elections, with only one parliament seat going to the opposition. A government spokesperson could not be reached for comment, but Ethiopia's government has repeatedly said that those imprisoned are criminals and not journalists. Human Rights Watch is calling on the Ethiopian government to release those imprisoned journalists and bloggers and to amend legislation such as the anti-terrorism proclamation. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington. Past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Rights groups say dozens of people have been killed this week during protests in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And Human Rights Watch accuses Ethiopia's government of systematically cracking down on media ahead of the May 2015 elections. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. Even though the Ebola outbreak in West Africa continues, the UN says it's time to plan for the recovery of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. A joint mission has just completed its assessment in Sierra Leone. VOA's Jody Kapowa reports.
The UN Development Program led the mission in Sierra Leone. It included representatives of the World Bank, the African Development Bank, the EU, and other UN agencies. David McLaughlin Carr is the UN resident coordinator.
The purpose was to try and work in a coordinated fashion towards gauging the socioeconomic impacts of Ebola on Sierra Leone. This country has taken a very hard hit, and Ebola itself, I think, has exposed a number of the structural weaknesses that need urgent attention by the international community.
The mission has assessed how Ebola battered Sierra Leone's economy.
Growth in 2013 was predicted to be about 11%. 2014, we think overall it will be about 4%. And in 2015, it could be less than 2%. That itself will tell you just what an enormous impact Ebola has had across the economy as a whole. Investment has basically dried up as companies have left the country, fearing, of course, contagion.
McLaughlin Carr says the Ebola outbreak crippled agriculture and mining, two big revenue sources for Sierra Leone, and two sectors providing livelihoods for many families. The mission has identified key areas for recovery, including infrastructure and basic services, sanitation, and health.
Health, of course, is absolutely fundamental to not only getting over Ebola, but also for the future development of this country. That sector really needs a lot of support at a structural level. There are systemic problems in terms of the lack of doctors and nurses, the lack of hospitals, the lack of, shall we say, local health clinics. And these are going to have to be addressed, I think, very aggressively.
McLaughlin Carr says very large parts of Sierra Leone lack access to clean water and latrines. That creates breeding grounds for mosquitoes and increases the risk of malaria.
Then, of course, there's the education sector. About 25% of children, even before Ebola, were not even in the school system. We need to, in a way, reset the agenda on education and have serious discussions to ensure that this country doesn't go backwards on the literacy gains of the past decade, but also can ensure that there's more inclusive education across the sectors.
The UN mission also recommends improvements in governance.
There are inefficiencies, there are accountability and transparencies that we need to build into service delivery in this country, and we'll be working very seriously with the government about having a conversation on how the UN system and the international community can support public sector reform in order to ensure that social services not only decentralized, but actually really deliver on the services they're meant to provide to the people.
The UNDP official also says the private sector has a huge role to play in Sierra Leone's recovery, but that requires restoring investor confidence in the country. A recovery strategy could be in place in a few months, but he says that depends on how much progress has been made against Ebola. In December, about 500 new cases were being reported each week. It's much lower now.
We're not out of the woods yet. We're still having in the vicinity of 100 to 200 cases per week, which is far too many. Disease as contagious as Ebola, one case is too many. We still have a major health crisis on our hands, which needs to be brought under control as quickly as possible.
The UN Development Program says poverty and environmental degradation helped worsen the Ebola crisis in Sierra Leone. The UNDP is also conducting assessment missions in Guinea and Liberia. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The number of new Ebola cases in West Africa dropped sharply last week, raising hopes the regional epidemic is on the wane. The World Health Organization says 145 new Ebola cases were reported in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone in the week ending January 18th. Only 8 of those cases came from Liberia, a tiny fraction of the 300 to 400 cases per week during August and September. 117 new cases were confirmed in Sierra Leone, but even there, the WHO says the number of new patients is decreasing quickly. The latest number represents a drop of more than 50% in the past 2 weeks. UN officials welcomed the reduction, but emphasized the need to stay vigilant and maintain the measures being used to control the Ebola virus. UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Valerie Amos said, "Complacency would be our worst enemy." South Africa reports that poachers killed a total of 1,215 rhinos last year. More than 800 of them were slaughtered in the nation's premier tourist attraction, Kruger National Park. TRAFIC, the international organization that monitors the illegal trade in animals, calls 2014 the worst year on record for the survival of endangered rhinos. David Newton is TRAFIC's Southern Africa Regional Director. He put the killings in context for VOA's David Arnold.
The majority of those, approximately 800, were poached in the Kruger National Park, and the rest in other protected areas as well as on private land. The total population of rhinos on the continent are 22,000 animals. They're being poached in most countries in the region. But at the moment, it is South Africa that seems to be really bearing the brunt. Mozambique has lost pretty much all of its rhinos now. So this is one of the reasons why South Africa is facing this onslaught. Its rhino numbers in Asia are also dramatically down. Sourcing of rhinos has shifted from Asia to South Africa.
What are the other elements that explain why rhinos are being killed in such high numbers?
It's a very complex situation. But in our view, there are issues, and despite all the good progress made by, say, the Department of Environment in South Africa to counter this, but we think that in South Africa we're facing issues, for instance, where the organized crime police units, the Hawks, is facing a lot of internal strife. We think that their attention has been distracted from the job in hand. Other issues to do with that are that the Mozambique government, I think, is not playing as strong a role as it could. They face considerable internal obstacles.
You mentioned internal troubles, both among the Hawks and in Mozambique. What do you mean by internal troubles?
At a very senior level in the Hawks at the moment, there are a number of suspensions of senior staff going on. And so from the outside, it appears that they don't exactly have their eye on the ball.
The numbers from traffic indicate 827 rhinos were poached in Kruger National Park in the last year. Game parks are supposed to protect animals, particularly rhinos. Are they not able to do that?
Especially in the Kruger National Park, there's been a really concerted effort to try and change that game. But simply, the organization is still not on top of this park. All the numbers being poached is really out of control. And there's also clearly a certain amount of internal corruption within the same park system, where rangers have been arrested for rhino poaching. The levels of organization required to counter this onslaught from Mozambique really doesn't seem to be adequate at the moment.
Well, one particular gang of poachers, I believe in the Czech Republic, how big an operation do they have in South Africa?
It's hard for us to say. These are organized groups. We see that as law enforcement is increased in one place, so trade routes move to other areas. When the rhino crisis first started, of course, we saw that a lot of the majority of rhino horn was going directly to Vietnam, very often via Mozambique, making use of airlines. However, we've noted recently, probably in the last year, that with the Vietnamese populations in the Czech Republic, there has been some engagement then, or change of trade route via the Czech Republic of rhino horns from South Africa going into Vietnam and other Asian countries.
Let me ask you about the London Declaration. What is it? What does it mean, and why isn't South Africa a signatory?
So the London Declaration was an attempt by the international community to try and galvanize this type of action internationally. Now, for reasons best known to themselves, South Africa decided not to participate in the final agreement. We think that that was a considerable omission. We really think that at this stage, South Africa should be trying to build as many friends and cooperative law enforcement regimes that they can possibly pull together. But the harsh reality at the moment is this poaching crisis.
That was David Newton, director of Traffic's Southern Africa region, talking about rhino poaching with VOA's David Arnold in Washington. Egypt's currency fell yesterday to its lowest point ever against the U.S. dollar, earning about 7.34 Egyptian pounds for the American currency. The Associated Press says the rate was 7.94 pounds to the dollar on some private exchanges and even lower on the black market. Economists say the move by Egypt's central bank to allow the currency to drop may be an effort to eliminate illegal trading. They say a less expensive pound may also help boost foreign investment, making Egyptian goods cheaper on European markets and help revive the country's tourism industry. And in Yemen, Yemen's president Abdel Rabu Mansour Hadi has resigned, according to a government spokesman in Washington. Yemen's cabinet has also submitted letters of resignation. The move comes amid a political tug of war between the president and the Houthi militia that has gripped the country since Monday. Citing a Facebook post by Prime Minister Khalid Baha, Reuters quoted the political chief as saying the government does not want to be involved in an unconstructive political maze. Witnesses said Houthi rebels remained outside the president's house a day after the two sides agreed to end a standoff in the country's capital, Sana'a. The agreement called for the rebels to withdraw and to release the president's kidnapped chief of staff, who remains in the militia's custody. A youth-oriented circus troupe in Uganda is using acrobatics to bring entertainment and education to some of Uganda's most destitute locations. The only program of its kind, the Hiccup Circus, regularly visits the most vulnerable in Ugandan society, bringing good cheer while spreading important information about health and safety. Elizabeth Polo has more from their headquarters in Kampala, Uganda.
Just outside of one of Kampala's major slums, a teenager practices his fire-spitting technique. The trick, the instructor tells him, is to purse his lips. Not far away, a juggler is practicing with tennis balls, and a young woman climbs into the air to practice her aerial acrobatic routine. It's just another day for Uganda's Hiccup Circus, a youth-oriented circus that aims to both educate and amaze. The brainchild of founder Giacomo Babaglioni, Hiccup Circus tries to focus on the most vulnerable in Ugandan society. For this reason, they have performed at schools within juvenile detention centers, slums, and refugee camps.
Why we target mainly schools? There are several reasons. First of all, the children, they are already there, so you don't have to mobilize. Second, even if we take smiles and entertainment and fun and these kind of things, schools remain an educational setting. So together with the entertainment, we can spread the message about education. This one is the main philosophy behind it.
Their upcoming performance at the Kirindongo Refugee Settlement, which houses over 3,000 refugees, mainly from the Democratic Republic of Congo in South Sudan, will focus on immunization and AIDS awareness. To prepare for the event, a professional clown therapist visiting from Italy teaches the youths how to commit to a bit through the art of silly walks. Babaglioni says the circus creates an innate sense of pride in those who have little opportunities elsewhere. With a high unemployment rate in Uganda and rising issues with idle youth, it is an excellent way to keep young adults focused on a goal. Sponsorship from various organizations also means that the circus performers are paid for many of their shows. One of the performers, 19-year-old Grace Amajong, says the circus gives her and her community a sense of purpose.
Circus is all about we go out to society and we pass out information socially, and then as well as entertain them, but at the same time we're educating them. I like to bring that information out because I'm trying to help people out there, and it I feel good when somebody takes in my information and then something is done about it, and that makes me so happy. Let's come and do something that is positive. It's going to bring a positive change towards the community and the society.
The Hiccup Circus, which is partnered with the Kampala Capital City Authority and the Ministry of Health and Education, hopes that in the following years, their core group of well-trained acrobats can in turn train younger children and expand the troupe and bring entertainment and education to some of Uganda's most destitute locations. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
On Straight Talk Africa, Zambians have elected their next president following the sudden death of Michael Sata. We'll discuss the results and the copper-producing nation's future next time on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Rights groups say dozens of people have been killed this week during protests in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And Human Rights Watch accuses the Ethiopian government of systematically cracking down on media ahead of the May 2015 elections. Coming up, music from Gambia. And in our feature segment, VOA's special series, To Protect and to Serve. I'm Yehius Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Yehius.
Sunny, what's the latest on the Nations Cup in Equatorial Guinea?
Yehius, Tunisia topped Zambia Thursday 2-1 to move to the top of Group B at the Africa Cup of Nations football tournament in Equatorial Guinea. Midfielder and captain Yassini Chikawi headed home the game winner in the 88th minute for the Carthage Eagles of Tunisia. The Chipolopolo of Zambia, who wasted some good scoring opportunities, opened the scoring in the 59th minute when Emmanuel Mayuka blasted home a cross from danger man Rainford Kalaba. Mayuka celebrated with a few backward flips, but just a few minutes later, he was stretchered off the pitch in Ebebeyin with a groin injury. An unmarked Ahmed Akachi equalized for Tunisia in the 70th minute on an easy tap-in following a corner kick. The final from Ebebeyin, Tunisia 2, Zambia 1. The Tunisians now lead Group B with 4 points from 2 matches, while Zambia has 1 point. Cape Verde will play the Democratic Republic of Congo in Thursday's second match in Ebebeyin. In results Wednesday, Congo Brazzaville moved to the top of Group A with a 1-0 victory over Gabon, and Burkina Faso and host Equatorial Guinea played to a scoreless draw. Both matches were played in the port city of Bata. Our African football guru David Legg takes a look back at the Group A encounters.
On a previous chat on your show, I was saying what a great Africa Cup of Nations we were having, and that was at the end of the first round. But sadly, the beginning of the second round, Sonny, not so great. Undoubtedly, the poorest match so far was that goalless draw between Equatorial Guinea and Burkina Faso. Now, goalless draws are not by nature drab affairs. I mean, some of them can be extremely exciting, but I'm afraid this one was not. It was really hard viewing, watching it from start to finish. Burkina Faso definitely had the better chances. They knew, Sonny, that if they were beaten, they were eliminated from the competition. And that would have been quite a come down for a side that 2 years ago went all the way to the final and gave Nigeria a real run for their money before losing 1-0. Strange enough, this is very much the same Burkina Faso side, the same faces, the same coach, Paul Putt from Belgium. But they're battling this time. And one of the reasons, which I've highlighted on the previous show, is the form of Jonathan Pitroipa. Now, he was outstanding in South Africa 2 years ago. He actually won the MVP, as they call it, the most valuable player. And that was quite an achievement. But he's just not firing on all cylinders in Equatorial Guinea in the 2-15 tournament. Again, against Equatorial Guinea, rather disappointing performance. And the real threat came from the Traore brothers, Alain, who's the older, and Bertrand. Now, Bertrand is on the books of the English giants Chelsea, but he's on loan at the moment to Vitesse Arnhem in Holland. But despite their chances, just as they did against Gabon, the Burkinabe Stallions failed to take any. And then in the second half, it was Equatorial Guinea who actually had a few good opportunities, including a great run by Javier Balbao, which ended with a shot just over the post. But if that was a boxing match, Sonny, you would have to say that Burkina Faso won it on points. But it was actually a football game. It finished 0-0, so they got 1 point each. Then on to the second game, and one expected Gabon to at least get a point, but it was not to be. The only goal of a game that was slightly better than the first, but by no means sparkling, came 3 minutes into the second half when Prince Onyango, who plays in the French League One. He pounced on a very weak-headed clearance from a corner, and his shot was well wide of the goalkeeper, Didier Ovono, and landed in the net. Thereafter, the Gabonese, who had the better of the first half, piled on the pressure, came close on a couple of occasions, but just couldn't break down a very well-organized, inspired Congolese defense. And the net result of all this, Sonny, is that Congo Brazzaville are now top of the table after two rounds. They've got 4 points. Gabon are second with 3 points. Equatorial Guinea are third with 2 points. And bottom of the table, which is probably a surprise to many of our listeners, Burkina Faso with a solitary point. And in the final fixtures, in Bata, it's Equatorial Guinea against Gabon. And in Eberbeyin, it's going to be Congo against Burkina Faso. And what these two matches now are turning out to be, Sonny, are basically mini-finals of their own. For example, if Equatorial Guinea beat Gabon, they will qualify. If Gabon beat Equatorial Guinea, they will qualify. And a tough task ahead for Burkina Faso. They're now 3 points behind Congo. Congo know that a draw will be sufficient, whereas the Burkinabe have to win. And that's never a nice situation to go into a final match at the group phase, knowing that only a victory will do. And even more than that, Sonny, because they've got a -2 goal difference, the Burkinabe may not only have to win, but win by several goals. And that really is putting the pressure on them. But it's all to play for. It's going to be a very brave person who would predict right now who's going to qualify, who are going to be the top two that will make the quarterfinals. Although I would have to say Congo are in a nice position. It's always good to know that a draw will be sufficient from your final game to make it. And on the other hand, I think Burkina Faso have got a lot to do, needing a victory and possibly a victory by several goals. And that's not going to come easy against the Red Devils of Congo Brazzaville.
David, as we talk, 19 different players have put their names on the score sheets in Equatorial Guinea. Do you have a favorite goal or goals plural so far in the competition?
The one I liked the most, Sonny, was from Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang of Gabon. It wasn't a classic goal. I don't think it's going to win goal of the tournament. But what it showed for me was amazing composure. Basically, he had a shot at goal. It was blocked by the Burkina Faso goalkeeper. When the ball rebounded to Aubameyang, if that had been a South African, he would have just slammed the ball into row X at least, if not a Z. But what Aubameyang did is he showed amazing composure. And, you know, I was speaking to several people about this issue of the goal, Sonny, and I said that in terms of teaching youngsters, or I guess players of any age really, about composure in the penalty area and how to score a goal, to me it was Aubameyang. He got that rebound. He knew exactly what he wanted to do, and he planted the ball into the net. And he's a class act, even though he didn't really figure prominently against Congo Brazzaville in their surprise defeat. So that one stood out. Another goal, Sonny, was the Cameroon equalizer, and partly because the scorer had no right to be where he was to score the goal. Here was a right-back who plays for the New York Bulls by the name of Oyango. Here he was right in the middle of the penalty area. He was played a superb pass. He controlled the ball very well, took it across the Mali goalkeeper, and planted it in the net. So for a defender, I've got to salute him.
David, how about another defender from Algeria, Fawzi Ghoulam, with a real howler against South Africa?
Yes, Sonny. You know, it was sheer power that was a great goal. I'd like to have known what speed it flew past the South African goalkeeper. Yeah, that was another good goal.
How about your favorite match or matches so far, David?
This is a tough one, Sonny. There have been plenty of good ones, but Sonny, I'm going to cheat slightly and go for those Group D matches, the opening doubleheader in Malabo. Guinea won, Ivory Coast won, and then Cameroon won, Mali won. There was so much spirit in those two matches, and they were really tense affairs. Right up to the final whistle, you sensed there could have been a dramatic winner for any of the four teams. And I particularly salute Guinea. I think they're the sentimental favourites. I think they're probably the team a lot of people will back as their second team after their own particular favourites. The Ebola crisis really wreaked havoc with this team. They had a lot of difficulties. They qualified very late in the competition. And here they are in the finals up against the likes of Yaya Touré and Company Limited, the stars of Ivory Coast, and they more than held their own. So far, so good, Sonny. Apart from these latest Group A matches, which I think certainly were a bit of a disappointment, but I think we've seen 8 good matches out of 10, and that's a pretty good average.
Pretty good average indeed, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, and we'll hear more Nations Cup commentary from David during the 3-week tournament, which culminates February 8th, when the final will be played in Bata.
I'm Shegu Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on.
Game on, VOA sports fans. I encourage our VOA football fans to check out our special Equatorial Guinea 2015 Nations Cup blog. The address, blogs.voanews.com/sunny. Once again, take a look at our exciting Equatorial Guinea 2015 Nations Cup blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. You'll see photos, videos, and stories about the African Championship Tournament. If you're just tuning in now to the Voice of America, Tunisia topped Zambia Thursday 2-1 to move to the top of Group B at the Africa Cup of Nations football tournament in Equatorial Guinea. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahéus Wuhib.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC right here on the Voice of America. Coming up, our VOA's special series to protect and to serve, an ongoing look at policing in the United States. And next, trying to find ways to restore friendly relations between rival cattle herders in the Central African Republic. But first, some music. Here is the Gambia's Jali Madi with My Love.
My love, you're like Jobal. Some of you are like Jobal. My love, you're like Jobal. Some of you are like Jobal.
Yeah, yeah, whatever reason one take, really to love and care for somebody else. Believe me, love should be noble, cause love is pure and humble. That's why man and woman combining, anyway, is something so defining. What should last forever while you care for each other? What? Each other? What? Each other?
My love, you're like Jobal. Somakira Kritibir, you're like Ojebal. My love, you're like Jobal. Somajemak, Someru, you're like Ojebal. My love, you're like Jobal. Somakira Kritibir, you're like Ojebal. My love, you're like Jobal. Somajemak, Someru, you're like Ojebal.
Lawa, 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 lawa
Woman, having a man is a pleasure. Who is your greatest treasure? Always comforting to be your measure. To have true love guaranteed for some. Woman, you are man's best friend. Who will be with you till life end? If you are good, he is glad. But he is sorry whenever you are bad. I love you like trouble. Some are going to be your life on table. I love you like trouble. Some are going to be your life on table. My love, you're like trouble. Some are going to be your life on table. My love, you're like trouble. Some are going to be your life on table. Yeah, knowing that love is kind, love is the power to move us to be kind. Even though it's hard to find, I'm gonna try to make you mine. Woman, I sincerely love you, so I do swear to protect you wherever you are. I'm with you until the day I die, believe me, it's no lie. Cause having you is a thing of beauty, it brings to me happiness, joy to my heart. I must stress, not to mention, but to say distress. Ning my dohe, I like that. Ning my hole, I like that. Nigga sicky, I like that. Nigga my pinny, I like that. I like that, I like that, I like that. Nigga, I love you like your bird. Some are gonna be your lap on jibble. I love you like your bird. Some are gemma, some are room, your lap on jibble. I love you like your bird. Some are gonna be your lap on jibble. I love you like your bird. Some are gemma, some are room, your lap on jibble. Nigga solo, I like that. Nigga, I like that. Nigga, I like that. I like that, I like that, I like that, I like that. Nigga, sexy, I like that. Nigga, la boogie, I like that. Nigga, boogie, I like that. I like that, I like that, I like that, I like that. I love you like your girl. Some are gonna be your life on jibble. I love you like your girl. Some are gemma, some are room, your life on jibble. I love you like your girl. Some are gonna be your life on jibble. I love you like your bird. Some are gemma, some are ruby, all are jibble. I love you like your bird. Some are gonna be your life on jibble. I love you like your bird. Some are gemma, some are ruby, all are jibble. I love you like your bird. Some are gonna be your life on jibble. I love you like your bird.
Gambia's Jali Madi with My Love. The use of deadly force by law enforcement officers in Ferguson, Missouri, and elsewhere in the United States in recent months has focused new attention on the procedures available to citizens to file concerns and complaints against the police. VOA's special series, To Protect and to Serve, is an ongoing look at policing in the United States. VOA's Ken Farbo reports on the efforts by the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department in Indiana to give citizens a voice in the effort to police the police.
Got dispatched to an alarm run at a residence.
Justin Henry is one of about 1,500 police officers patrolling zones in and around the city of Indianapolis, where about 1 million people either live or work. Henry's job puts him in contact with some of these citizens every day. For a policeman, each encounter is different, often uncertain, and sometimes dangerous. Police Chief Richard Rick Height says his officers work to deal with that uncertainty by being proactive about knowing the people they police.
And meet some of the residents before an issue occurs, so that you're no stranger when something happens in the community and you show up. Your job is to go out there and be a problem solver.
But when a citizen has a complaint with an Indianapolis police officer, Chief Height will know about it.
Police complaints, how may I help you?
Thanks to the Citizens Police Complaint Office.
We offer that citizen an avenue to say your voice is valuable and you do have a voice in this process, that the police can't come in and treat people however they want.
Laura White heads the office, whose complaint board is made up of 9 appointed civilians. It also includes 3 law enforcement officers, but they don't vote on cases under review.
We're an independent agency of the police department. We are there as an avenue for the citizens of Indianapolis to articulate complaints that they may have had during a law enforcement engagement with a police officer.
The complaint process in Indianapolis was established in 1989 by city ordinance to ensure independent accountability.
They review the case, the complaint, the investigation, and then they render a decision on the findings.
But the results of a 2012 audit conducted by a consulting firm contracted by the city found that there were serious restrictions on how the complaints were filed. Laura White, who took over the office after the audit, says she believes recent figures for 2014 indicate the process is working.
We had 110 total officers that had complaints filed against them, and out of that, we had 45 disciplines that came out of that. So almost half resulted in a discipline.
When you add the element of civilians into the process, they're able to look at it with an outsider's perspective and make sure that the investigation is done fairly and consistently over time.
Cameron McElhenney is a former member of the Indianapolis Citizens Complaint Board and now serves as the director of training for the National Association for Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement, or NACOL.
I think what Ferguson and other national cases have done for oversight is made not just law enforcement agencies, but city leaders and members of the community understand is that this isn't something that should be done after something has happened, that maybe it's time to start doing oversight ahead of time so that bad things don't happen in communities.
Though the complaint and review process can be intrusive and disruptive for the officer or department involved, Chief Height welcomes the scrutiny.
We have to have checks and balances. As we often talk about, it's important to recognize there are quality compliance.
Let me have a channel a minute, please. I'm going to deploy the search from Madison.
A 2013 study by California State University Fullerton shows that more than 100 police departments, many in large cities, have civilian oversight boards. While New York City has such oversight, the Ferguson, Missouri City Council only voted last September to set up a civilian review board. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Indianapolis, Indiana.
The International Crisis Group said last month that a hidden conflict is underway in the rural parts of the Central African Republic. The conflict is between cattle herders, who are mostly Muslims, from the Puel ethnic group, and farmers, who are mostly Christians. Livestock experts are looking for ways to restore friendly relations between the communities and to prevent more of the violence that has torn the country apart for the past 2 years. For VOA, Nick Long reports from Bambari, a town on the cattle trail.
A mission of livestock experts from a National Cattle Herders Federation, international aid groups and UN and government agencies recently visited rural areas of the Central African Republic. The group found that nomadic and semi-nomadic cattle herders are generally not welcome in agricultural areas. Clashes develop when the herders come under attack and then retaliate. Almost inevitably, the fighting takes on religious or ethnic overtones. Displaced people living at a camp in Bambari told VOA they had fled from the Pearl. This man, Yakbanga Vianney, says, "We, the Christians, the Central African people, are in difficulty because the Pearl are making war on the Christians. That's why we have taken refuge at this site." Most CAR residents are Christians, while the Pearl, a small minority in the nation of 5 million people, are usually Muslims. Recently, aid workers say about 1,000 Christians have been relocating to Bambari every week to escape dangerous conditions in their home villages. The attacks on villages often seem to be reprisals for attacks on the Pearl, usually carried out by anti-Balaka militia groups. This man, Ngeri Bisikoa, tells VOA his village was attacked and many houses burned by the Pearl, who thought the area was occupied by anti-Balaka members. The violence around Bambari has mainly been happening along two roads leading south. They seem to be front lines between anti-Balaka coming from the west and the Pearl, who have been driven out of many of their grazing grounds. A health worker at Bambari Hospital, who gave his name as Alex, explained.
Okay, this area is occupied by Bororo's people, who are cattlemen, the Pearl. But there is invasion of Balaka people there. That's why all the time there are movement, there is fighting on this way.
Much of Bambari is controlled by a Pearl warlord, Ali Darassa, who has set up his own movement called the Union for Peace in the CAR, or UPC, its acronym in French. The UPC spokesman, Captain Ahmad Nejad, blamed the anti-Balaka for most of the burned villages, but he acknowledged that Muslims have committed reprisals.
La quasi-totalité de ces villages qui sont incendiés, c'est incendié par des anti-Balaka.
Even if Muslims do sometimes burn a village, Captain Nejad said, There will have been a reason, and so long as the anti-Balaka don't touch anyone, there won't be any reprisals. A seasonal migration of cattle from north to south is now underway, and the Joint Mission of Livestock Experts warned this could lead to further violence. The experts recommend placing peacekeepers near the Chadian border to help minimize violent incidents. They also say that providing vaccination services for cattle might persuade herders to follow recommended trails instead of allowing their livestock to roam over cultivated land, a common practice that is one of the root causes of bad relations between herders and farmers. Nick Long for VOA News, Bambari.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Audrius Regas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For more than two decades, a small, ruthless armed band has terrorized a large area of Central Africa in a campaign of kidnapping, murder, and rape. The group, calling itself the Lord's Resistance Army, has committed hundreds of attacks across Uganda, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, South Sudan, and the Central African Republic, forcing some 465,000 people to flee their homes. Uganda, where the group originated, and its neighboring countries have struggled for years to counter the LRA. With the support of the African Union, the United Nations, the United States, and the wider international community, efforts to end the group's depredations against civilians have seriously weakened, but not yet completely eliminated, the group. Operating in the vast areas of South Sudan, eastern and southern CAR, and northern DRC, the LRA has been reduced to what is believed to be a force of just a few hundred fighters. Since 2012, over 250 LRA fighters and noncombatants have abandoned the group and come out of the bush. Early this month, one of the group's top three leaders joined them in abandoning the fight, surrendering to U.S. military advisors in the CAR, and he called on others in the LRA to do the same. Dominic Ongwen's surrender was a major step forward toward securing the future of the LRA-affected areas of Central and Eastern Africa. It is a visible symbol of our successful partnership with the African Union's Regional Counter-LRA Task Force. Ongwen has been indicted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes and crimes against humanity. All parties have agreed that he should face justice, and we commend the governments of the Central African Republic and Uganda for their collaboration and cooperation in this process. Per an agreement between the AU and the governments of the CAR and Uganda, Ongwen was transferred to the custody of the AU force. He will then be handed over to CAR authorities for transfer to the ICC. The fight will not end there, however. Joseph Kony, the LRA's supreme commander, and his deputy, Okot Odhiambo, who still command a small cadre of fighters, remain at large. Their surrender or capture would end a reign of terror for the people of the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.